gentlemen. You know, the custom is for the chairman to introduce the guest speaker. And the chairman presumably is well known to you, and the guest speaker isn't. That's just the reverse tonight, and it was suggested Mr. Dr. Book should introduce me. However, just for form's sake, I'll introduce him. You all know Eric as Vice President of Faculty and Student Affairs at the University, and Professor of Physics and Chairman of the Triumph Organization. The trouble is that he's so deeply involved in administrative functions, he's so well known as, and so good at being an administrator, that we lose track of the fact that he's also one of Canada's leading nuclear physicists and a very great scholar. He's he graduated in Manitoba back in 1951, where he, of course, he got a gold medal for honors physics. Went on to take an MA, and then he took a PhD at Princeton, did some graduate work at Birmingham, and then went, like all good nuclear physicists, to Chalk River, where he stayed for at least 10 years, I believe, and finished up as a senior research officer. In 1965, he came to UBC as a professor of physics. And he very soon became involved in the Triumph Project. In 1968, he became director of the Triumph Project. And since 1974, he has been chairman of the board of the Triumph management. Eric Vogt has won many awards and distinctions. I won't go through them all now. His latest, as late as December of last year, was to be made an officer of the Order of Canada. Just what Triumph is, what the word means, what the project means, what it is doing, and what it's going to do in the future, I leave to be answered in the very capable hands of Dr. Eric Vogt.
Thank you, Jack, for that very kind introduction. And let me say a bit about Jack. He was one of the founding fathers of Triumph. He was on the first board of management. Bill Armstrong, of course, led that board of management through all its early years. And we also have in the audience tonight many of the people who brought this project about. I want to talk about that project today. 9 years ago, I spoke to the Vancouver Institute about the dream of Triumph. A dream was shared by a number of physicists here in Western Canada. At that time, 9 years ago, the project was not yet funded. Since then, it's been built by the scientists and engineers of four universities: University of Alberta, University of Victoria, Simon Fraser University, and the University of British Columbia. It's much the largest and most ambitious science project ever undertaken by Canadian universities, and its completion has proceeded smoothly. More recently, the experiments for which Triumph was built have gotten underway. I want tonight to report on those experiments, to give you some impressions of the facility on which they're being carried out and the prospects for the future. Let me make some remarks to my colleagues who are here in the audience. First of all, they may be wondering, like the audience is, why I'm giving this talk tonight and they aren't. And the reason for that is that I'm on the program committee of the Vancouver Institute. Secondly, scientists often wince when their work is being presented to a lay audience. To let the audience know tonight when they're wincing especially hard, I've decided today to play background music when I exceed the bounds of scientific decency. Finally, for a project covering many new fields, I should point out right at the beginning that the choice of topics of the experiments that I've chosen is a purely personal one and is based in part on those ideas which I thought I could convey to an audience without excessive jargon. And this in no way represents a scientific judgment of the people whom I will not mention or of the PhD thesis to which I will not refer. I'm going to start with some very basic ideas and impressions of the Trium facility. First of all, we're going to see an aerial view of the Trium project, and if you look in that large building on the south campus of UBC, a very large building, if you look inside it, you see deep inside it a large cyclotron, much the most complex cyclotron ever built anywhere. Inside the bowels of that building, as though in the inner sanctum of some religious cult. Well, this large project was built to produce beams of particles for probing subatomic matter. Particularly, it was built to produce large numbers of new kinds of particles called mesons, which have never been used in quantity in science before. These mesons are extremely short-lived, and they're used to probe the inside structure of atomic nuclei and of neutrons and protons, and also of mesons. At present, the pictures we have of atomic nuclei or of the particles associated with atomic nuclei are very crude indeed. One might compare and contrast our knowledge of atoms with the knowledge that astronomy provides us about the solar system and also the universe beyond that, where one seeks the orbits of the planets rather than the orbits of neutrons and protons in atomic nuclei. Compared to astronomy, we are at present in nuclear physics, just beyond the Stone Age. If we wanted to go back for a moment, 4,000 years in time, when man's knowledge of the solar system roughly equaled that which we now know about the nucleus, what we would see would be the following. Here we have, in the Salisbury Plain, a large circular device, which was used by the earlier astronomers at that time to obtain information about the orbits of the Earth and the Moon, and of the Earth around the Sun. This was a very major undertaking, and the people who built this used it, lined up stones very carefully, a number of them, so that they were able to obtain precise alignments of the setting sun. They also used stones at some distance from the inner circle. Well, I think if we think for a moment about the science produced with this device, let's remember that this was used to plot particularly the solstices. For anyone who's walked along English Bay in June and watched the summer sun just reach the lower notch of Mount Elphinstone, it's perhaps not difficult to comprehend that man was driven early, almost compulsively, to study the solstices and to wonder about the mysteries of the solar system. Well, that went far enough so that at that time the geniuses who built this were in fact able to predict eclipses. At least they had enough information that they could have predicted eclipses. Now, why did it stop at that time? And that's something that we should perhaps wonder about for a moment. Why did we have to wait 3,500 years until Newton came along and provided us with the very simple picture in terms of which we now understand the solar system and the motion of the planets? It seems likely that the sheer magnitude of the effort to build Stonehenge raised many questions. People conceded that its results gave pleasure, at least to some, that it contributed to transport technology. You know, they moved these stones a long way. They said that they learned something about the seasons and therefore contributed to agriculture. But others complained that the result of such efforts, one had, in fact, here we see the circular symmetry of Stonehenge, which we're going to return to. But as a result of this, one had stones littering the entire English countryside. And so people complained. They also said that on the other side of the English Channel, one had greater resources for that sort of thing. What seems most probable that stopped the science at the time is that they created a science council during whose deliberation science was abandoned and the general population returned to that greatest of all human pleasures, slaughtering one's neighbors. That's the kind of enjoyment one is still to be derived from page 6 of the Vancouver Sun or from Vancouver's or from Vancouver's open line radio programs. Well, that's astronomy 4,000 years ago. In nuclear physics now, we are at about that stage in our knowledge and the kind of knowledge that we have about the systems involved. Well, we're now going to take a big leap forward. And watch the Triumph cyclotron as it was being assembled a few years ago. This is a piece of the vacuum tank built in Richmond here by a firm that used to build hubcaps and did a superb job of building a vacuum tank with one of the most impressive specifications ever built. This is the large Triumph magnet built in Quebec City with its spiral shape needed to keep particles in orbit for 30 miles while they're being accelerated in many circles. Here we have the tank going over the wall from the area where it was assembled into the cyclotron vault where it will rest on the magnet. You see these Stonehenge-like pillars all the way around the vault. In fact, what we're building here is an iron henge, about the same shape and size as Stonehenge. The vacuum tank here is slowly being lowered onto the magnet. Our people moonlight for the Vancouver Symphony Orchestra. Yes. Now you see the top lid of the vacuum tank, which was also prepared in the room next door, 60 feet across. It has to hold a vacuum of 1/100,000,000,000th of an atmosphere and has to support a tremendous vacuum load. That tank is a 1/8 inch thick stainless steel and has given us no problems ever since it was built. Here they're getting ready
the rubber seal around the edge of the tank, which seals the lid to the tank walls and keeps a perfectly airtight vacuum everywhere, which is needed to accelerate particles. I'm going to have shown you that small snippet of a film from Triumph. I'm going to now show you some quick impressions of the rest of the project, and then I'm going to tell you about the experiments that have been carried out with Triumph. So I'm going to go back to my slides. And now we're going to see some shots. Here you see a model of the shielding around the Triumph, again showing that Stonehenge-like shape of the object we're building, or built. Here we see the magnet as it was being constructed with all of the people on it. You saw that also on the film. You see that shape of the magnet is one which is actually extremely old. This is a shot George Volkov took in Armenia of an Armenian shape, just like Triumph, something like 2,000 or 3,000 years old. We're not sure what they were up to. And in fact, in history, you often see people gazing at plaques of that sort. I have another shot like that. Here you see a shot of that same plaque that you saw in Armenia, that same shape of a sector of the magnet is again displayed on this plaque when the Prime Minister opened the project a year ago. Now, my next slide shows that large vacuum tank when we had none of the gear in it to accelerate particles. We were simply measuring the magnetic field carefully. That vacuum tank has to be extremely level. This is an optical instrument, but an extremely precise instrument. It has to be level to a few thousandths of an inch all the way across, in spite of the millions of pounds of pressure, vacuum pressure outside it. One sustains that tremendous vacuum load by having rods anchored to the wall of the tank. Those rods are anchored from the bottom of the tank to the floor of the cyclotron vault, which is 11 feet thick reinforced concrete. It was being poured here. To that concrete pad, we have these various rods attached to the vacuum tank. This is a shot from underneath the cyclotron showing magnet pieces and the attachments of the rods to the vacuum tank. They support this tremendous vacuum load. In fact, when we evacuate the tank, the center of that floor, 12 feet thick, lifts up by a millimeter. And the whole thing has to be aligned extremely carefully. Here we see the resonators inside the tank, which provide electric fields inside the vacuum tank to accelerate the particles. There are 80 of these. Each of them has enough stainless steel that the price of it would buy a Cadillac. And we have to line them up, again, extremely carefully so that they provide the electric fields for acceleration that are being installed here. Here we see the cyclotron when it was more or less completed. Normally now visitors cannot get into the vault, certainly not when we're running. But here the top half of the cyclotron is lifted up about 4 feet from the bottom half of the cyclotron. We see on this slide a shot taken of the cyclotron nestled in its vault. It has walls 15 feet thick so that people can work perfectly safely above it and outside of it, even when the cyclotron is running, but of course not inside. Here we see the vault completed with the 15-foot thick roof. The ions, which are accelerated to 3/4 of the speed of light, start their path here in an ion source. They travel along, then go vertically down 45 feet into the center of the machine, where they start their spiral path. in ever larger circles. They go out after a trip of about 30 miles. The accelerated particles emerge into the laboratory where we want to use them. Now, what about the laboratories? This shows an architect's plan of, first of all, the cyclotron vault, and then a small laboratory, only 75 feet by about 100 feet, on one side of the machine, into which we extract beams of particles. I'll say what kinds of beams in a moment. And a number of experiments are going on in here, as we'll see later. This shows a general shot of the experiments in that area as they were being assembled. They're now covered with concrete and visitors can't see them. The beam of particles, nearly at the speed of light, of protons, emerges from the vault wall here and then travels through this array of magnets and one carries out experiments in this area here. This is the first set of experiments I'll describe later occur in this area right here. Next, one has another simultaneous beam emerging from the other side of the cyclotron into an experimental hall about the size of a football field. This is where the most intense beams are generated. Protons travel along this beam line here, strike a target, and mesons are produced, short-lived particles, which are really bundles of energy. They're produced right here, and they travel in all directions. And one collects them with magnets as efficiently as one can. And the point here is to use the mesons themselves to study subatomic matter. I'll show you a shot taken in this area here where we have... No, first of all, we look down the main beam line as it was being assembled. This is the target where the mesons are produced. Now that looks more like this. The main beam comes in here, strikes a target here, and then these other arrays of magnets collect the mesons as efficiently as possible. Systems of magnets to collect mesons. There's another shot of that here. These are the mesons which are being led off from the main target here, led off into an area where they're being used for medical therapy, or at least will be used shortly. Next. This was, 2 years ago, the first beam of triumph, as it was seen at that time just before Christmas on a measuring device in the control room. That was a very happy event. The project has, since that time, begun its experimental program. It's a matter of about 3 years going from first beam to full operational intensity. We'll be there in about a year's time. And at present, we are able to accelerate beams to the design intensity for very short periods of time. The machine hasn't been shaken down completely to operate full time that way, nor do we have the shielding in place to operate that way. We're operating about 10% of full intensity at the moment. Well, I want to say something now, first of all, about the various beams that we have in Triumph and what we do with them. And then I'll describe some individual experiments. So, going now to that layout of the facility again, we have the cyclotron in its vault. We have two large experimental areas, one called a proton hall, one called a meson hall. Used simultaneously in Triumph. What kind of beams do we have in them? Well, first of all, we have proton beams shown by blue lines here. They're peeled off of the cyclotron, and the main proton beam comes into this area here where it strikes a target and mesons are produced. In the proton hull, we use the protons themselves for experiments. Next, I'm going to show you where the beams of mesons called pions exist. These are
the red lines here, the mesons are produced here and collected in those magnets which you saw, then brought to the experiments where we want to use them.
These mesons last the pions, which are the one of the fundamental particles inside atomic nuclei. They last, unfortunately, only a little bit more than a billionth of a second. That doesn't seem very long, but it's long enough before they break up spontaneously. It's long enough that we can use them in experiments. They can travel a few meters in the laboratory to the place where we want to use them. So they last a little bit more than a billionth of a second. Then they break up into other mesons, another kind of mesons called a muon. I'll be talking about pions and muons. The pions are the fundamental particles created when the proton beam strikes almost any target in nature. They travel, and as they're traveling, they break up spontaneously into muons. And then we collect the muons with the same set of magnets and use them instead if we want to. So we have the green lines here for muon beams. The other kinds of particles we have are neutrons. The proton beam strikes a nuclear target, and neutrons fly off in all directions, and we can use the neutrons, the purple lines here. And we are at present using some neutrons. We will be using far more than the main beam stop of the main beam line later on. So we have all of those different kinds of beams. Now, as far as the mesons are concerned, this facility is an extremely important one because it will produce 1,000 times more mesons than have been available before anywhere in the world. And for that reason, this machine is called a meson factory. There are three facilities all beginning operation in the world now which are meson factories in roughly the same regime. This means for these machines that they produce proton beams of sufficient energy to produce mesons. That means, in the jargon that nuclear physicists use, several hundred million electron volts. One has to have the protons travel through a tremendous voltage before they're kicked to the high energy where they can produce mesons.
So that we have machines of that energy to produce mesons.
In addition to that, these machines have enormous intensity, 1,000 times more intensity than accelerators in this regime before,
and that's why they produce such a tremendous number of mesons.
Now, they're not the highest energy machines in the world. There are some very large machines in Russia and one in the United States which have low intensity and high energy, which are used to study the properties of atomic particles as well. And they produce more kinds of mesons than we do, but not enough of them that one can use the mesons themselves. So these facilities, the three meson factories, one in Switzerland, one in the United States, and one here in Vancouver, are now going to pioneer the fields of science in which one uses mesons as probes of matter. And that's their main function. Now, these three facilities are really quite different. They're very different accelerators. They all produce these kinds of beams, but they have different characteristics. Of the experiments I will describe, about half of the ones done here could have been done on one of the other accelerators. But the machine here has some unique features that make some of the experiments, perhaps a little bit more than half of the ones we do and will do, possible here only. And so that is attracting teams of scientists from around the world to TRIUMF, and will continue to do so for many years. So we're talking now about
a meson factory which produces beams of particles, which uses magnets to collect those beams.
I thought I would show you just for a moment how we use magnets to electric fields to steer beams around. This is a beam of electrons, like you would have in your TV set at home. And I have in my hand here magnets, which I can use to push that beam around if I like. If you have some magnets at home, you can try that with your TV set. And so that you can push beams around, guide them, if you have appropriate magnetic fields. Or you can do it with electric fields. I can create quite a large electric field simply by rubbing the screen
And you can see what effect that has on the electron beam inside. It pushes it aside. So electric fields or magnetic fields generally can push beams of particles around. And that's why you saw so many magnets in those pictures. I'm going to show you now some of the ways in which we use beams to study subatomic matter. And I'm going to spend a few minutes, first of all, in giving you some general principles about how we do this. So we have a beam. We want to study an atomic nucleus. We want to study the particles inside an atomic nucleus. How do we do that? Well, there are basically three different ways in which we can do that. The first way that we do that is that we might do an experiment which we call a scattering experiment. I'll demonstrate that for you here. I have here a beam, a laser beam. You see that red dot coming out of this instrument. It's a helium laser, and you see the beam on the screen. Now, I can send that beam through an appropriate material, emerging at different angles compared to its original direction. We call that a scattering experiment. There's some of my first-year physics students in the class, and they could have told you by looking at that pattern what it was that I was scattering, what the structure was, that there were, in fact, three or four slits, very narrow, close together, far closer together than you could see with the naked eye. But by shining the laser light on them, we are able to unravel precisely what those slits are. We can do a scattering experiment with laser light to do that. We use the same principle with beams of protons or mesons or neutrons or whatever. And you'll see that in some of the results that I'm going to show in a moment. So the first thing that one does with beams is you scatter the beam and you study the angular pattern. An angular pattern and a scattering experiment. The second of the three important methods that one uses is also a very fascinating one. And it's generally called resonance. You watch how the system resonates under certain conditions. And I'm going to show you some examples of that. We all know that if we get into a small room and sing at an appropriate frequency, that room somehow responds in the right way. This room is a very large one, and I can't sing notes quite low enough to make this room resonate. So I'm going to do something different. I'm going to make something much closer to what one does in an atom. I'm going to make a thin soap film resonate. What you see here, all I did a few minutes ago, I created a soap film here, and I'm scattering ordinary white light from a projector off of it. And you see beautiful bands of color. What is actually happening here is that the soap film is only a few atomic layers thick, but it constitutes a box in which the light bounces back and forth, just like sound does in a shower. And we can tell from the where the film is red, where it's red over here, that is the right size of box for red light. Here we have the right size of box, right thickness of film for green light, etc. So the pattern that we get, the color to which that responds, tells us the size of the system. Now for light, the color or wavelength or frequency is the same thing as talking about its energy. So that a given size box resonates at a given energy. And we're going to see that again with the waves of particles that we have. We're going to see resonances as a function of the energy. I'm going to show you another example of that, of a resonance. A resonance can be more complex than merely one arising from size. Here we see, 35 years ago, the Tacoma Narrows Bridge being caught by wind. It has natural internal vibration frequencies, torsional oscillations. And if under the right wind conditions, it was able to resonate. It responded to the wind in the right way, as you can see. I don't know whether you feel that way sometimes going over Lionsgate Bridge, but but this bridge, in fact, moved that way under quite strong winds. This was not long after it was built. And you see the tremendous response it has to the wind that was pushing it. You can see from the cars that this happened in about 1940. Well, on November 7th, shortly after that, not so many minutes after that was taken, that's what happened to the bridge. So, many systems have the possibility of internal vibrations, and under certain conditions, if we have the right kind of, if we have the right kind of waves exciting it, then that system starts vibrating at its natural frequency. I have here the kind of device that we use every day when we tune our radio or TV set. What we simply have is an inductance coil and a capacitor. And we tune that. What do we mean by when we tune it? We mean that in that system we can set electric fields sloshing back and forth, just like the Tacoma Bridge was sloshing back and forth. And if we emit a radio wave somewhere nearby, it will respond to that. I can do that here. I can set up a radio transmitter here, and you're going to see the system light up when I do that. That's an old system, and it has to warm up a bit first. We'll give it another minute. Now, I can remove it, and of course, then I'm not receiving enough. The amount of signal I'm receiving changes with distance. But when I bring this system back here, there, I'm changing the internal frequency of this system so that the waves slosh back and forth. And I can adjust that by adjusting the tuning knob. I'm adjusting it so that the system which is sending out waves is exactly matched to my receiving system. And so we have a resonance here. Well, that's a kind of a system which we can also set up in atomic nuclei. The particles we're dealing with here can all be thought of as waves, and we're going to see how they can make systems resonate. The idea here will be simply to measure the response as we vary the energy. Sometimes we get a tremendous response at a certain energy, and that's when we say we have a resonance. So we have scattering, a pattern versus angle, resonance, a tremendous response at the right energy. The other system method that we use to study subatomic systems is a method called reactions. What we really do is simply bash one subatomic particle into another and watch the pieces fly off. It would be just as if we studied watches by having one watch bombard another watch and look at the pieces flying off in all directions and then try to determine from that what happened inside the watch. We don't need to study watches that way, but subatomic particles, that's sometimes a useful way for studying them. So reactions is yet a third method. So we're going to look at scattering, we're going to look at resonances, and we're going to look at reactions. Now I want to spend the rest of the time I have on specific experiments from TRIUMF. And I'm going to look at experiments in all of these areas. We have a pion therapy hospital there. That's a story almost in itself, and I'm going to neglect that. That's something the Institute might very well want to hear about at some time, at some later date. The idea here is simply that the pions, being bundles of energy, are very useful in treating certain kinds of cancers because they can be introduced to the right place and dissipate their energy at that point without damaging the overlying tissue as much. They've been doing some preliminary experiments at TRIUMF on the survival rate of cells when they're irradiated by pions, but it'll be another 2 years before that becomes an important technique for certain kinds of cancers at TRIUMF. But I will not talk about that. What I will do instead now is, first of all, talk about experiments which are going on in the proton hall. In the proton hall, we have this proton beam coming off along the blue line. And for about a year now, a group of scientists from the United Kingdom and from the University of British Columbia, there are about a dozen scientists altogether, perhaps 7 or 8 from the United Kingdom, have been studying the fundamental interaction between neutrons and protons, the basic building blocks of atomic nuclei, and between protons and protons. The forces involved are nuclear forces, which we only understand slightly. Now, we're here at a range of energies, of proton energies, where almost no accelerators have existed before, and there have been almost no measurements before of this interaction over a wide range of energies. And it has been mapped out here in a large number of experiments, almost complete now, over the last 12 months or so. Now, the protons themselves are particles. The protons are the particles. They're one of the constituents of atomic nuclei. Or another way to put it, they're the nucleus of a hydrogen atom. And they have a spinning axis. Just like the Earth has a spinning axis, the proton has a north and a south pole. It has an axis through these about which it's spinning. And the kind of interaction it has with another spinning proton depends on how those two axes are aligned, whether they're pointing both up or whether they're pointing one up and one down or whatever. And so one has to do a variety of experiments in which one aligns the spinning axes of the protons and measures basically the scattering. This is a scattering experiment. The first method that I mentioned, where we study the angular pattern as a function, the angular pattern of the number of protons scatter, or the number of neutrons scattered as a function of angle. Now, I'll just show you one or two pictures about the kind of results that they've been obtaining. This is here the angle relative to the incident proton beam. We have a proton beam and we measure the scattered angle just as I could have with that laser beam. The black points here are the data obtained here. And this happens to be one energy where a few earlier measurements existed. But basically here, the scattering pattern has been observed much more completely than it's been known before. And it's been mapped over a wide energy range. And it's been done here using beams of particles with their spins aligned, or we call them polarized particles, so that we look at all possible configurations of the spins, really determine the force completely. Enough new data has been collected so that later this month, David Measday and his colleagues are going to have a large international conference here
on the nucleon-nucleon interaction, on the interactions of such particles, in large measure that will be based on the new work coming out of the Triumph machine. And that will really throw, I think, a great deal of new light on what that basic force between neutrons and protons and protons and protons is. So that's a scattering experiment among some of the fundamental particles. If we return to our hall for a moment with all its beams, to the proton hall, I'm going to look at now some experiments in which we study reactions. There's a group from Simon Fraser University which does the following. They say, we have an incoming proton beam, we intercept that with a silver foil, and then watch pieces that fly off in different directions, fragments. They might be different atomic nuclei. We strike silver and look at carbon or beryllium or boron or other nuclei, pieces of flying off from the silver. Silver is a rather heavy nucleus. And we study that as a function of the angle of the emerging fragment. What they see, well, first of all, they have detectors which can distinguish the different kinds of fragments. You see here in that bombardment, they can distinguish fluorine, oxygen, nitrogen, carbon, boron, beryllium isotopes, lithium isotopes, etc. When they look at that now, they look as a function of the energy of the fragment and the angle of the fragment simultaneously. And the kind of question they ask is, was the fragment there in the nucleus in the first place, and did you simply knock it out? Or was it somehow, did the proton pick up various pieces which later constituted this fragment and it emerged? One wants to study the mechanism by which such fragments are ejected in this rather violent collision. So, of course, what happens to the silver isotope, it's split up and chips of it come off and it's changed into quite a different isotope. And that brings me to another topic. At the same point, at the same place in the laboratory, one is also producing, or can produce in the same way, new kinds of isotopes. And let me talk for a moment about that. What kind of isotopes can we produce? This is actually going to be a multi-million dollar business at Triumph before long, and I'm going to contrast that to the kind of isotope production which has existed for some time from nuclear reactors. In a nuclear reactor, we take a nucleus, which has neutrons which are blue and protons which are red here, and a nuclear reactor is really a sea of neutrons. And we can create new isotopes with the same number of protons, but extra neutrons, simply by the original nucleus swallowing these neutrons, which hit it from all directions. So, for instance, you can create in a nuclear reactor plutonium, which nobody wants, or argon, or iodine-131. Iodine-131 happens to be an isotope which has sales of, I think, in excess of $10 million a year in the United States. It's used for treatment of thyroid disorders and for all kinds of investigations involving, for all sorts of radiography. So iodine-131 is a very valuable isotope. Well, that's what one does in a reactor. Now, what do we do in an accelerator? In an accelerator, instead, we have an incident proton which heats up that system. The nucleus is really a very hot gas of neutrons and protons. When it is struck by an incoming proton, neutrons boil off in all directions. And so instead of getting extra neutrons, we get fewer. Instead of having iodine going from iodine-127 to iodine-131, iodine-127 is the normal iodine isotope of nature, we can create iodine-123. Which is also useful in treating thyroids. Well, in fact, turns out to be much more useful because for the same information obtained in a thyroid irradiation, one has 100 times less dose. And so for much of the use of iodine isotopes in medicine, iodine-123 would be very much more preferable and will undoubtedly supplant it.
Well, we're the first people really that are going to produce this in quantity, And a few months ago, we produced our first iodine 123, and here was a thyroid which was irradiated. And in fact, one uses it also to study how growths from the thyroid metastasize in other areas. Well, this is just a chart taken from the VGH here, from the very first sample produced last fall. We expect that this production of isotopes produced in this way is going to be a multi-million dollar business in a few years. And there are many new kinds of isotopes which one can produce by bombardment of nuclei by high-energy protons. There's another kind of thing that you can do, which is really the same thing we saw here, where the neutrons fly off in all directions. And this was discussed in the papers extensively a few weeks ago. A group at Simon Fraser is collaborating with the Chalk River Group to study whether one cannot produce fuels for reactors using these neutrons. In a reactor, we have a sea of neutrons, and neutrons cost a few million dollars a pound. And the question is, can you produce them more cheaply this way than you can in a reactor? And the answer is quite possibly yes. That's been a dream for a long time. The United States spent about $100 million on a project for that in the 50s for rather immoral purposes, and it never really got off the ground. The technology wasn't there at the time. That was for the weapons productions. The technology still isn't really quite there, but it is probably around the corner. In a triumph, they're going to do some target studies to see whether or how feasible this method of producing neutrons cheaply really is. That's called electric breeding. I'm going to go now to quite another area of the hall and look at some of the meson experiments. We were looking now at proton experiments. I've neglected a large number of proton experiments here, particularly by Alberta scientists, in which they study the way protons produce resonances or scattering in atomic nuclei. And quite a few experiments of that sort have been completed, but I'm not going to talk about those today. I'm going to instead, first of all, talk about the experiments with the green particles, the muons, which are produced when the pions decay in flight and produce muons. The muons last a very long time. They last almost a millionth of a second. And so that means they can travel across the laboratory. After all, they travel nearly at the speed of light, and light travels a great distance at a millionth of a second. And so they can not only travel across the laboratory, they can also settle down and do a number of things, as we'll see in a moment. A number of things in matter. And so we're going to look at what those muons do. Now, it's interesting, the way the muons are produced, they come off in a given direction, and they're also spinning particles, like the Earth. They're spinning. It turns out they always have their spinning axis pointing in the direction in which they're traveling. And so here's the muon traveling along, and its spinning axis is pointing in that direction. And now you stop it in matter, and it's still pointing in that direction. It sits there, pointing in that direction. Now, in matter, it may be subject to a magnetic field. And a magnetic field tugs on that axis and makes the muon, we call it precess. The axis turns around. I'll show you how that works. I have here a spinning muon, which is spinning. And now I'm going to tug on it, and that makes it turn around. Now, the particles the muons emit also point along its direction of spin. And so if my flashlight corresponds to the light emitted by these particles, you see it acts like a beacon, a searchlight, which as the magnetic field is tugging on it, it goes round and round. And if you're sitting there where you are, you see every once in a while that certain beacon shines on you, and then you receive something. You receive a signal from that muon. Now, how fast it precesses depends on how fast the magnetic field is tugging on it. And we'll show you what they do. Right.
We have Don Fleming in the audience, who's involved with a large group of people here. Well, not so large, but perhaps half a dozen people, some of whom are from the University of Tokyo. And they turn a clock on. When the muon stops in matter, it lasts, after all, a millionth of a second, and it begins in the matter's atomic field, say in an iron crystal, to precess around and around.
And so they turn on a clock, and here's what they see as a function of the time. The time here is measured in millionths of a second. This is half a millionth of a second, the whole axis here. They have quite a good clock.
And you see this beacon effect, that it turns round and round and round. And you study both
how rapidly it's precessing, and you study how that precession dies out. And you study that here as a function of the temperature, from 23 degrees Kelvin to 290 degrees Kelvin.
This kind of an analysis, which is called muon spin research, is going to be a powerful new tool for measuring solid-state systems, because the muon can be deposited in between atoms in a solid and can help to determine the magnetic fields which exist in various sites in an atom.
It's a very new field again, and for the first time anywhere one really has enough muons to pursue that field.
So that's the muon in solid-state physics.
And that goes on in this green line here, in which this group from Tokyo and UBC stole magnets from a number of places in the world and are now carrying out those experiments.
I'm now going to talk about more muon experiments. And here, probably, these are John Warren's experiments, and I should probably turn on the music again. because they're a little fanciful.
David Measday also. In these experiments, we have, first of all, we're going to look at how electrons and muons are related, or are they related? We know that when we talk about the electron which exists in nature, there is an electron which has a negative charge and positive charge. Also, part of the same family, or so we think at present, we have two particles called neutrino. One is called the electron's neutrino, the other is the electron's antineutrino. And the charge I've indicated here, this one has negative charge, positive charge, and this one has zero charge. The muon appears, to all intents and purposes, to behave exactly like the electron, except that it's heavier, about 207 times heavier. There's a negative muon, a positive muon, and two neutrinos. So we have these two families of particles, which seem to be somehow, which may be somehow related, but we do not know how. What is the property? Is there something else inside that tells us that these are part of the same family? Well, the answer seems to be yes. That if we look, first of all, at the electron, it seems that there's something inside,
we don't know what it is, which we simply call the electron's family number. The electron,
the normal electron has a plus amount of that, the positive electron a negative amount of that. The neutrino, which has no charge, has a plus amount, negative amount. And the muons have none of it.
Now, charge is always preserved in nature. We can never create or destroy charge, at least so it seems. We can never have a positive and a negative electron, two positive electrons together, and they suddenly change into two negative electrons, or vice versa. The total amount of charge seems to be an absolute law that you can never destroy or create it. Maybe it's true with this thing we call family number. At least the reactions that are possible seem to indicate that. Now, for the muon, we have a corresponding family number called the muon family number. Now, we invented those terms simply because they tell us what's possible and what isn't, what the rules of the game are, although we have no idea really why those rules exist. So, they tell us, for instance, that in the normal way a muon breaks up, it breaks up into a negative electron and these two neutrinos. And if you look at the boxes I've created, we see that the charge is the same before and after. We see the electron family number is the same, zero before and after. The muon family number also. So that, we say, that kind of a breakup is allowed. It obeys the rules. We can think of another breakup
here, which is forbidden. The muon would break up into an electron plus a light particle called a photon. The charge is okay, it's the same on both sides. But the electron number is zero on one side and plus on the other. That breaks the rule. The muon family number is also not the same on both sides. That breaks the rule. So that's called a forbidden muon decay. Now the question is, does it or does it not occur? There was a flurry of excitement a few weeks ago across the world when one of our competitors claimed that they had a few events in which they saw that once in 100 million times a muon breaks up this way. We had been planning to do that experiment very carefully, shortly, but the announcement that that might be so speeded up the work here, and in a few weeks, David Measday and his colleagues here at Triumph were able to look at that experiment, I think, more carefully than anybody else could in the world. What does one need to do? One needs to, in these experiments, if you want to detect something like this, you need to detect that photon which comes off, or you need to detect the very energetic particles that are created in these experiments. Now, for ordinary light, our eyes are very good detectors. That's why we see. If we look at the light emitted by nuclei, which has an energy about a million times greater, we can't see that with our eyes. The way we detect light emitted by nuclei, atomic nuclei, is we have that light incident on a crystal. This is a normal sodium iodide crystal that one uses. And that photon of light enters this crystal, produces electrons, which in turn produce normal light that we can see, and then measure the amount of light and determine the energy of the gamma ray. That's for normal events in atomic nuclei. Here one needs much bigger crystals. And it turned out that David Measday had such crystals available. And here you see, instead of this small crystal, he has something many cubic feet sandwiched between his twin daughters. And there were two of these large crystals here, enormously expensive. David asked me not to say how expensive they were, which are useful for detecting this sort of a reaction. Well, that's been measured now. And the experiment finished last week. And I'm sorry to say the result is negative. That is, this forbidden decay doesn't seem to occur. If it had, it would have been perhaps the first essentially Nobel Prize-winning experiment carried out here because it would have told us that the muon and electron are related in a way that no one had suspected. Of numbers, family numbers, is not necessarily unique. There's some people that would have it another way. They would say, instead of using that scheme, let's use something called lepton number, which is a different scheme, which allows different sort of reactions. Now, John Warren is pursuing an experiment in which he is creating positive muons and creating a substance called muonium. And it is very much like a hydrogen atom, except instead of the proton in the hydrogen atom, we have an atom made of a positive muon and a negative electron, held together by their electric forces. You can create that system. Now the question is, does that system sometimes spontaneously change into what one calls antimuonium, in which each of the particles have changed their charge? Under this scheme, the blue scheme here, that would be allowed. Under the schemes I showed you before, it would not be allowed. And so, if we see events of that sort, one would be able to tell something very fundamental about the rules that muons and electrons follow, how the two families are related. The search is difficult because you have to search for these events in a very low vacuum. Now, you can't create the muonium in a very low vacuum. What you have to do is you have to create it in a solid and then create the kind of solid in which the thing rapidly diffuses outward. It was John's idea, I think, to use magnesium oxide, very small pellets of magnesium oxide, in which have tremendous surface area, and so that there was a large chance that these things would then diffuse outward into the vacuum where this kind of conversion could take place.
Well, that experiment isn't completed yet. It will be underway seriously in the next year or two,
but it is another way of probing how the muon families and the electron families are related. Now, we go on to my last group of experiments, and I hope I can have about 5 more minutes. Yeah, I'm going to talk about pion experiments with the red beams involved.
There are a number of pion experiments involving all 3 methods, scattering, resonances, and breakup.
First of all, let me show you with the red beams a scattering experiment. Here, we vary the angle in a scattering experiment, and we watch the number of pions here scattered off a carbon-12 target. The pions here have an energy of 30 million electron volts. So, the data are these points shown here.
And those curves are various curves that various theoretical physicists have calculated. Usually, if they work long enough, if they see some data, after the fact, they get reasonably close. And you can see this dotted curve here. Well, they would call that reasonably good agreement. You know, one can't be perfect in sciences such as this, and some of these curves don't look very much like the data. But this is really a pion in a box, just like we had the soap film, which has now disappeared. We had that soap film in which we had a photon in a box, a light particle in a box. Here we have the pion in a carbon-12 box. Now, a better experiment of a pion in a box is to look at a pion incident on a neutron or proton. Here we have such a resonance experiment showing the response when we bombard pions against neutrons or protons and vary the pion energy. Then we see at certain energies we get a tremendous response. We call it a large total cross-section. That's the data. And this can be thought of as a pion in a nucleon box. This is one of my students recently, as part of his work, fitted that data with the pion in the box description. Glenn Rowe's description is like that. Now, the size of the box in that case is, if you take a box this big and divide that by 1,000,000,000,000, you get the size of the box in which that pion is resonating. It's really a very small box indeed, but it behaves that way.
Now, there are other experiments going on with involving pions. Here's an experiment which a group of UBC people are involved in which they take the incident proton beam and have that proton beam strike a carbon target. And they look for events in which a pion is produced. A pion is chipped off. This is a reaction. And the question here is, can you think of that incident proton as being part of the time a neutron plus a positive pion?
Is the proton really a composite particle of that sort, at least part of the time? If it were, then we would get a distinctive angular pattern corresponding to that picture.
It turns out, when you look at the data for that sort of an event, I think we need to look here only at, this is the angle again, the pion angle coming off, and here is the normal carbon. We can also do the same experiment with carbon in various other states than the normal state, but look only at this state. We see that the pion prefers to come off at forward directions. That does indicate that perhaps the kind of picture in which one thinks of the proton as being part of the time, a neutron and a pion, is a valid one. But that is something that's still being argued about. Now, I'm going to
close by talking about the place that pions have in nuclei generally.
And here, I'm going to look at the future.
And I'm going to look inside an atomic nucleus now and talk about the kinds of experiment that I'd like to do. And first of all, we're going to look deep inside a nucleus and look at the neutrons and protons, and they follow separate paths. They're in orbits, the kind of orbits that we're trying to learn more about, the kind of orbits for planets that the Stonehenge astronomers were trying to get. Now, what is it that is holding these neutrons and protons together? Well, it's perhaps a little loud, but I think that you get the message. But the thing that is holding the neutrons and protons together is they're interacting, in fact, by exchanging pions. What happens inside a nucleus is that here are these neutrons and protons, and they're constantly interchanging pions. They're like playing catch with them. We call those virtual pions because they don't really exist. They can only travel, there's not enough, these pions are the ones that are involved in the nuclear force. They're even involved in the force between a free neutron and a proton, not inside an atomic nucleus, which play this game of catch in which a pion is exchanged. The energy to create that pion can be borrowed only for a very short time, and it can only travel a very short distance in that time. And that's why the range of nuclear forces is extremely short. Very strong forces with very short range. So we speak about a nucleus as having all of these pions present only very momentarily, as long as the quantum rules allow them to exist. And they're really part of the interaction. These pions are part, as it's another way of describing the nuclear force that holds the neutrons and protons together. But now you ask the question, are there, in addition to those pions involved in the force, are there also real pions present in the nucleus? Is that possible? And so you ask, is it also possible that sometimes in a nucleus, you see, a pion, which is not only there by virtue of the interaction, but which is there in its own right, smiling in its own orbit. Now, what does one mean by that? The answer to that isn't completely clear at the moment, but one could put it roughly this way, that perhaps, that first of all, there's enough energy inside a nuclear system to create other particles. It isn't necessary that the nucleus of an atom is made up of only of neutrons and protons. There could also be other particles, such as pions, present. And the question as to whether or not they're there is a question of whether or not we can describe this system in a simpler way by putting pions into orbits and having those pions interact with the particles, or are we content merely to have the normal nuclear interactions which we study in isolated experiments with neutrons and protons? Are we content to have the virtual pions present only and borrowed for short periods of time? Or the real pions, of course, would last longer. They could travel in orbits through the system or be part of the system for a while at least. Now, that question has not been answered. And I think the way it will probably be answered, one way that I think that it will be answered is to look at the resonance processes that pions undergo before they disappear in the nucleus. Normally, they don't have very much time. They last less than 1 billionth of a second. And that's a very short period of time. But during that time, they may, in fact, associate with a few nucleons and travel an appreciable distance through an atomic nucleus, which is a very small object. And the question is, if they do that, do they last long enough so that they also produce one of these resonance responses that we saw on the Tacoma Bridge or that we see every time we tune a radio? The way we look for these, the way I would like to look for those, is to bombard a nucleus with pions and look at what happens when the pion disappears, particularly in those events when a large number, and see whether in the response curve for that reaction one sees resonances, which would tell you that you can indeed describe the mess inside an atomic nucleus better by dealing with real pions. picture perhaps also sums up our tremendous ignorance at the present time. We know that the nucleus is an arena in which probably neutrons and protons are the primary components. Maybe there are other things. We know that all kinds of forces take place, so the electric forces, which are important in the nucleus. We know that there are also the intrinsic nuclear forces and forces called weak interactions, all of which take place in this arena. And so the atomic nucleus is really an extremely complex object. You can make it shake, you can make it rattle, rotate, vibrate, almost any of the kinds of motions that we think of in our everyday world. In addition to that, you can make it do that through all of these complex interactions. At the present, we really do have no picture like that. Our knowledge of the nucleus is much more primeval than that. We're just beyond the Stone Age, but we hope that with the new tools we have available, we'll be able to make some significant steps forward. Pions as a probe may very well, for the atomic nucleus, tell us things completely different, just in the same way that radio astronomy in this century has given us completely different pictures of the sky. We were so comfortable with the sky 70 years ago, but then when people turned radio telescopes to the sky, they discovered black holes, quasars, neutron stars, all sorts of things, and we're now much more puzzled than we were. Although there are also many things that we understand better. I think that's what will happen with these new probes for subatomic matter. With the muons and pions and protons that we're going to use here, we're going to learn more about what happens in this complex arena, and we're probably also going to be puzzled more. Thank you.
Dr. Vogt knows the rules. In fact, I think he made some of them about answering questions. So if anybody would like to ask any questions, I actually direct them to Dr. Vogt himself.
Yes. Yes. Well, there are various classes of accelerators. The question is, why are the three Meson factories different? There are various classes of accelerators. Some accelerators accelerate particles the way a surf rider gains energy from waves. You set up a set of electric waves traveling forward, forever pushing the particles. Those are called linear accelerators. The accelerator at Los Alamos is a much more expensive device than ours, which uses that principle. It's a linear accelerator achieving the same kinds of energies. Ours is a circular machine in which the particles in a cyclotron are repeatedly kicked by the same electric field to high energies. The Swiss machine is also a cyclotron, but of completely different design, which in fact prohibits them from varying the energy or from extracting simultaneous beams as we can. It was designed earlier, before all the design features of our cyclotron were available, so that I think ours is perhaps in some ways the most flexible, and I think also the most recent of the three machines. The most recent to get funded, but they're all starting about the same time.
Is there any simple way that we can describe why the Trent project is able to produce iodine-123 more easily or in greater quantities than other projects?
Well, yes, the question is, why can we produce iodine-123? First of all, compared to our reactor, my point was that in a reactor, you add neutrons. You produce neutron-rich isotopes. In an accelerator, you produce neutron-poor isotopes. Iodine is a neutron-poor isotope, so it needs an accelerator, not a reactor. Now, this is not the only accelerator in the world that could do that, but you need one with at least more than 20 or 30 million electron volts, and you need one with tremendous intensity so you can create commercial quantities of the isotope. And there haven't been many accelerators in that regime before. There haven't really been intense accelerators with intense beams for that purpose before. It's not the only one that could do it, though. Other questions? Yes, Joe.
How do you account there a positive charge on one side and a negative charge on the other? And how do you explain the difference between these two?
Well, we can never have...
constant. It's always absolute positive on one side, negative on the other. I'd like to
understand. He's asking how we can have positive charge on one side and negative on the other. We never have a reaction in which we lose any charge. We always have to balance things out. It's like an extremely careful banker that always insists that everything comes out exactly right. Now, with charge, that's true. That is, we cannot have 17 positive charges, charge particles in a pot here, and then have them interact, produce all sorts of strange things, and after we look at the pot again, there will be again 17 positive charges. Maybe completely different particles, but again 17 positive charges. Electric charge seems to be something that we just cannot somehow destroy in any way. Yes, Belle.
What happens to people strolling by your project? How many will catch your little friends by accident?
How many particles?
Yes.
Well, first of all, the accelerators are licensed by the Atomic Energy Control Board, and I think the rules are very stringent for what can happen in our perimeter, and also for the kinds of shieldings we have for the people that work there. We have to build a fence around so that people cannot wander around anywhere in the project, but people on the perimeter of the fence have very low radiation doses indeed. Joe Bergeron is in the audience. He can perhaps tell us how low they are at present, but they're perhaps 100 times below cosmic ray background?
Yes, it's about that.
Okay. I think that's what we're limited to, so that if you wander around Triumph, you're having about the same hazard as if you went a few hundred feet up on the North Shore and or lived in the lower levels of the... Or lived anywhere near the granite in the North Shore.
Perhaps worth mentioning many times more radiation than you would get if anywhere near any accelerator by just flying across the Atlantic Ocean.
Yes. Yes, when you flew to Hawaii at Christmas, Bell, you got much more radiation than you will in quite a few strolls through Triumph. Yes. Yes. Ken?
Have you checked with Doug Collins about this iodine business?
You mean about selling it? Right. Yeah. Well, actually, we're probably not going to sell it ourselves. All I would like is an agent's fee. Yes. 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 Yes.
More people should hear about it.
Right. Well, the question is, what are we doing about public relations apart from tonight? I guess you saw there was a national TV show about it a few nights ago with Triumph on the Suzuki's Science magazine. We take every opportunity to tell the public about it. I guess we feel strongly about that because. I think at the time of Stonehenge, the results that people got were probably appreciated by only very few people working there who were part of the cult. And that's true sometimes for science. I think there's a great deal of interest among people in general in the results of science. And I think that they have a right not only to pay for it, but also to enjoy the pleasure from it. And so that I think that's shared by the people at Triumph, and I think that we take every opportunity we can. I don't know of anybody at Triumph who's ever turned down an opportunity to talk. John Warren will speak, I don't know how many times a year, John. Yes?
Is it possible to say whether these experiments have made the universe seem more or less stable?
The question is, have these experiments made the universe seem more or less stable? I don't think they have much to do with that question directly. I think that the universe is very complex, and I don't think that we're beginning to understand its complexities. And if you think that they were going to push knowledge to its ultimate limits, I think that would be a futile hope. Yes?
When the muon breaks up,
it breaks up into an electron. Well, I guess we had that on. It breaks up into an electron and two neutrinos, a muon neutrino and an electron neutrino. And that happens after about a millionth of a second. And then we get a lot of energy, and those two kinds of neutrinos emerging. I didn't talk about the neutrinos. There's some kinds of experiments one can do with them, too. In a sense, we also have neutrino beams. But the experiments with them are extremely difficult because the neutrinos tend to travel through about a billion times the moment of matter we have in the Earth before they get stopped. And so you really need very efficient detectors for them. Yes? There have been discussions with Atomic Energy of Canada Limited, which is very strongly in the isotope business. They actually make money out of it. And they're interested in thallium isotopes, I think iodine. There's a list of four or five which seem of marketable at present. But I think we're just beginning to know what the neutron poor isotopes are that are valuable. And so I think we'll start with a couple, but probably principally iodine and thallium. And thallium, I think, is used for heart treatments of various sorts. Another question back there.
How many years before you have to shut it down?
Well, you mean before they turn the funds off? No, that's not correct. I don't know who said that, but that's certainly not correct. I think that an accelerator, there's strong radiation levels when the accelerator's turned on, but the moment you turn off the beam, the accelerator, the levels are not that high. That after a few hours, people can work inside the cyclotron, which is the hottest place of all. And so, no, they're not residual buildup problems at all. I think... The question is more, what is the useful life of such a machine? When does it become an old model? And it's probably more like a Volvo than a Ford.
I was wondering if it's possible to use a machine of this type for manufacturing Turing.
No, I don't think it has anything to do with the manufacture of deuterium. There are many ways one could produce deuterium, but I don't know of any way that we would do that with this particular machine. You want to market it, or? Yes?
May I ask if you are involved in any way with weapons research?
No, there's no weapons research that I know of that has ever taken place in Canada at all, and certainly not here. And I certainly have never been involved with any, or nor know of any. I have never myself known of any weapons research that has gone on in Canada. It may be that people have sometimes done things that I don't know about, but I don't know of any.
CBW.
Pardon?
CBW.
What's
chemical
that?
Biological.
You mean, what about chemical and biological?
Well, that research has been done in Canada.
Yes, but that's not weapons research. He meant atomic weapons, I think.
Yes, nuclear weapons.
Nuclear weapons, right. Right. Oh, yes. Oh, no, we have a... I guess if weapons research, after all, we have a defense research establishment, which I would guess that many millions of dollars they've spent have certainly been spent on weapons, but not on nuclear weapons. Yes? No, well, the forbidden one is it broke the rules. Now, the question is, does it really break the rules completely, or do you mean never, 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 or just hardly ever? And what kind of a rule is it? Because some rules, you know, are very strict. Charge, conserving charge, it seems to be absolutely strict. But there are other rules, quantum rules, which don't seem to be quite so strict. Now here, the experiment, I think, at present says that the rule they were looking at there, which involved both electron family number and muon family number, they know that that it happens less than 1 in 100 million times. That means they really had to have to look at many events. We're really creating hundreds of millions, billions of muons. In fact, we're creating billions of muons every minute, I guess, by now. And so that one looks at billions of events and sees rarely, occasionally, does that happen? And the answer seems to be, sadly, not. I think that's still true, David, isn't it, today? Yes. Yes. Well, there will be a major pion therapy unit hospital connected with it, and with Triumph. So that is certainly that's something I said I was not going to talk about tonight. It's important and interesting, but I just chose not to talk about that tonight. There's also the isotope production. There would also be a possibility, which is being explored. I didn't talk about it, about proton radiography, in which you take pictures of internal organs using proton beams. There are a number of other ways. You could use the proton beams themselves to or the neutron beams which we generate for therapy. That may all be down the line, but at present I think the true story is that the pion therapy seems to be the most interesting thing. And in fact, it's important enough at Triumph that Marc Lalonde declared Triumph about a year ago to be the second project in Canada of national importance for health because of the pion therapy. Yes. The protons?
Yeah.
Yeah, they end up as heat, yes. So that we generate something like a few hundred kilowatts of heat in the beam stop from the beam itself. The accelerator uses a few megawatts of heat, less than the rest of the UBC campus, UBC campus, but still an appreciable amount. I think that it's something that I don't think is something very major for British Columbia. That isn't the reason they want to build more dams, but we're nonetheless a big user. Our power bill is something like $500,000 a year. Yes?
When you have an event that occurs a billion times.
Yes.
And then it occurs differently.
Yes.
How do you catch it?
Well, it has a signature. Those events, the normal decay has certain kinds of particles. So you sit there patiently clocking away the normal events. You can detect what comes off, the pieces that fly off. But in the forbidden mode, different pieces come off. And they give a characteristic signal in your detector that allows you to detect them. So that even though they occur so rarely, the detectors that you have tell you for each single event when it happens. Now, we saw that clock that Fleming had that measured events in millionths of a second. One can actually take separate events happening roughly every billionth of a second. So you can count individually events about a billion times per second. And so in a day where you have 100,000 seconds, you can count a vast number of events. And so that if something happened once every billionth time, in principle, you could collect thousands of those events per day, and even sorting out all the events individually. But you need very good clocks.
Could you give an example of some forbidden event that has been verified in some period?
Yes, there have been many forbidden events. Depends on which rules you want to look at. There are whole classes of rules depending on whether you're talking about atoms or nuclei or elementary particles. In each of those fields, one has rules of that sort which are broken. So I would sort of have to go through the fields to
I was curious, you used the word exception, I think. When you do verify one, do you use the word exception then? Or
because, yes.
But it's a regular recurrent feature of some sort, though, isn't it?
Yes, but it would still be an approximate rule. Yes. Yes. Well, most of the particles, most of the particles are spinning particles. The pion is an exception, but that means they have an axis. The axis may change in space. For instance, magnetic fields can make it change. We can bend the shape of the axis. Just like the Earth's axis is also changing. Every 26,000 years, the North Pole moves through a big circle. It's precessing just like that bicycle wheel was. And so the forces, in this case for the Earth, it's the bulge of the Earth being pulled by the Sun that makes the Earth precess. But so that particles generally have spinning axis. Now that axis can change its direction. No, continuously. Well, when we except, of course, when we talk about quantum systems, there are specific rules. We talk about quantum jumps, in fact. The world at that level isn't quite the same as the world we're used to. When this bicycle wheel changes its axis, it changes continuously. In fact, the muon jumps from this spin to this spin. There are only two possibilities, up or down, for instance, for the muon. That's the way the quantum world works for it. But that's another story.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, I think that the time has come to give our speaker a rest, although I'm sure he could carry on for another hour. I think I gather from what he was saying and what came up in the course of the meeting that we have at least one or two more lectures coming from Eric Vogt next year or the year after. Perhaps we make it an annual thing. Before I call on Bill Weber to thank our speaker tonight, I have two short announcements to make. The first is about next week's lecture. We're going back not to Stonehenge, but pretty far back, 500 BC, to hear a talk by Geoffrey Woodhead, distinguished Greek historian, English Greek historian, who's going to talk about the failure of an experiment, the Athenian democracy of 500 BC. Dr. Woodhead is a distinguished and fascinating lecturer, and he's coming here by courtesy of the Cecil and Ida Green Foundation. And secondly, I'm going to ask Eric to program us experiment to find a good substitute for coffee at Triumph. But until he does so, we're going to ask you to come drink the old stuff, which we have here afterwards in the hall. Eric? Bill?
Tied up in his work. I think, however, it's a particular privilege tonight to have heard from someone who was in on the intellectual conception of a major project, and in addition, through a great deal of determination which he and others demonstrated, saw that project develop, and now this evening has been able to explain really a very sophisticated area of science to us in a way which I think has been most instructive and entertaining. Thank you very much.